Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on our grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, depth. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
Tonight we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats, football history in its memory, on the Sports History Network, and in conjunction with Swick Enterprises. We're live from the Southport, North Carolina, home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover over 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It's time I'd like to introduce my co-host, the senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, and in particular, Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular, Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show.
Captain, you ate your Wheaties this morning. That was one of the most, energy-filled intros I've had from you. I mean, glancing up the camera is like you're staring through my soul at that. I love it. Well done.
it's funny. Yesterday, I did a show with my friend John Verparian in White Plains, New York, obviously via same video type of setup. And he said after he got done with the show, he was exhausted because I don't think I stopped talking. He threw questions at me, and I just rattled off answers nonstop. So he says, it's much easier when you have a guest that talks. I said, I know that well. So I said, I said, John, I'll help you out again as I normally do. This is probably like my fourth or fifth time on the show. I used to drive up to White Plains, New York.
Oh, and that's cool.
In the studio there. And then Brenda and I on the way home, we'd stop for a late lunch and then head. But obviously, I can't hop in the car and drive to White Plains, New York anymore. That'd be
not quite. I'm curious. When we did the first podcast, when you used to do that over, because our podcast used to be only audio. And I'd listen to that. Before the first show, did you practice that? How did you work on the preamble? Because I don't think it's changed.
No, it hasn't. I wrote it and I kept practicing it and I bounced it off a few people who were non-football people. And they said, wow, that sounds pretty interesting. I really don't know much about football, so I'll listen to it.
It's really good.
I just stuck with it. I mean, we've been using that for many years now.
Yes, I've got it practically memorized. That's why when we switched to the YouTube to the video format,
yeah,
surprised to see you glancing down at notes because I'm like, I practically have it memorized.
No, I know. I know. I just try to keep my place. And then I always have to go down on my notes for the special guests and the questions, yeah, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
One day I'll try to do it clean.
But, so like all the football, I mean, did you work on that? Were you like, hey, Brenda, what do you think of this? Because at first you're like football. And you're like, no, I feel like I should.
I wanted to emphasize the football part of our show. And I, what better way is to emphasize that word and put some energy into it? I mean, think about this. And I go over a lot of our podcasts that we went over the years. I used to listen to them 2-3 times just to try to critique myself. And again, since I have a gravel voice on the air, it sounded a lot more, I thought, distinct but not so much distinct. It sounded old-fashioned in the sense that it's like you were listening to old-time radio.
Totally.
And I always wanted, this to be a throwback to the magazine that we're going to go back in time,
Totally.
check out whatever it may be, whatever type of collection, collector, so on and so forth, and we're going to do it in a vintage sense. I today, again, because I'm a dinosaur, there are a lot of podcasts I just can't listen to because they're, in your face, screaming at you.
It's a morning zoo. It's like a morning zoo on the radio.
Yeah, exactly. And trying to listen to some of these sports talk podcasts and just try to gather information out of it becomes really difficult. For example, if we're out and we have a lunch and they got ESPN on and they got all the talking heads on, I mean, I'm watching it for like 5, 10 minutes, and I don't even know what they have said. And they're interrupting each other, they're cutting, they're yelling at this, yelling at that, and I stop watching it. I mean, it's not really pleasant,
I was
So
at breakfast with some friends yesterday, in a in a hotel bar that my friend owns, and over his shoulder was the display, the TV behind the bar showing ESPN. Well, Stephen A. Smith was on. Every time they panned over to just his big head and just talking, oh my God, I can hear his voice, and I'm literally he they would flash over to him, and I'd see him. And I'd just be like, oh, that is fingernails on a chalkboard. Just his voice, just that. And he's been made famous by just being like a contrarian.
And it's sad because again, one of my degrees is actually in journalism, so I took a lot of broadcast courses. I took a lot of writing courses. I actually was a disc jockey for a few years back in the late 70s, early 80s. I did voiceover. I did commercial work. So,
I didn't know that.
I have some understanding of what the concept of broadcasting used to be, because today I'm troubled because I really don't know what it is, especially when it comes to sports. Trying to watch a game on TV, trying to listen to the broadcasters. I say this all the time, Amazon Prime football game, I shut the sound off. I can't take it. I'll listen to Westwood One Radio where I know at least I have a couple guys attempting to describe the action and I can follow it on TV. And there are few, in my opinion, really good broadcasters anymore in any of the sports. And again, the one sport that you really need to know what you're doing broadcasting is hockey. And unless you know your positions, unless you know what's going on the ice, and you can describe it even on TV, that's becoming a very lost art in broadcasting, in my opinion.
It's funny. I was watching an interview with John Madden years ago, and he said, people think, being an announcer is about knowing football and talking. He's like, it's actually knowing when not to talk. It's knowing when to just let the action,
Exactly. And then the greatest broadcasters of all time knew what to do.
knew when to shut up.
Oh yeah.
I forget, Barbara Walters was talking once, and she's like, people tune in to hear my guests. I mean, she's Barbara Walters, obviously, but she's like, and so many people talk, and she's like, if I'm interviewing Bono, people want to hear Bono talk, not me pontificate about my stories. And she's like,
The way I look at it on this show, all I am is a literally a traffic coordinator, and that's it. We're going to funnel some information here and let the information play out, and that's
Sometimes we get guests like the last couple weeks we've had where
Ben
he's
Carpenter.
so passionate about his books. You hit the finish line and I'm exhausted just by listening to him and watching him. This, I mean, he was great. He's excited. He's he's passionate about his hobby.
And the wealth of his knowledge is just incredible. And again, he's the type of guest you love to have on because he is so informative. He's so respectful, in my opinion, of the hobby by what and how he describes things. I think that's a great
Well, before the show, you and I were talking about our backdrops because I always try to have, not to have backdrop envy, of you or the guest. And I always look at people's backdrop because it's, if you're going to come on to something like this, it's something that you love and you're passionate about. So I'm always
Sure.
looking at your backdrop. You don't rearrange it much, but I see the three or four wax packs of 89 Pacific, the Steve Largent one over your right, your left, viewer's right shoulder, a Bart Starr hanging in the upper right, and then
Poster. Caps poster. Yep. Yep.
what I focused in on was that Army Navy ticket that,
Yep.
like I said, is the game that I missed because my wife said we had something to go to, and that Scotty Otten,
Yep.
Colonel Bullbird, Colonel Scotty Otten, who is a Army Navy ticket collector, helped design that ticket, invited us to the game, and I couldn't go. And
Yep.
you said one of the top five things in your life you've ever gone to, which
I never
really helped the pain.
that to me was a top three game. The whole experience, the game itself. I mean, I guarded that ticket with my life. And whatever they call them, the hang piece
Lanyard,
that I had.
lanyard,
And
yeah.
it was just incredible experience. But again, that's the pureness to me of what sport is, and I think we kind of lose it every once in a while, dealing with what we deal with today with sports, so on and so forth. I mean, right now the NFL coaching carousel is laughable, and everybody is discussing the playoffs, so on and so forth. Are these the four best teams in the NFL? Right now, technically they are because they all got there. That's what it comes down to. So I'm going to start off immediately a little auction action that you're going to talk about, and then we're going to go into some actual Seattle Seahawk playoff history. And
We
yes.
might be jumping the gun here. I am wearing, my Seahawk
All
sweatshirt
right, yeah.
to counter your Packer one. But yeah, I wanted to talk about a little auction action. Where did my folder go? Here it is. Whoops.
Auctions are everywhere,
Excuse
day and
me.
night, 7 days a week.
Yep.
Anywhere you go, anywhere you look, you can find auctions.
Well, first of all, hang on while I get my technology going. First of all, this guy up in Heritage, couple days left. It is hanging around $35,000 right now. What do you think of that card, Captain? Look at that. Centered nicely.
Got a little you can tell it's a three. It still
Yeah.
presents nicely.
Yep.
I think anything Nagurski right now is out of control
Yep.
because of the demand of it.
Yep.
I'll go out on a limb and say that probably will go well into 70s and 80s, if not more. So.
Totally agree. Very well centered. Just has a couple little bat ears, upper right, lower right. Beautifully rounded corners. A little bit dirty. The back looked good. I didn't take a scan of that, but it's fascinating how we look at these cards all the time, but how often do we really look at them and just look at the detail? His right
Right.
hand resting on his hip, left to us. I've
Yep.
looked at that hand and went, they didn't quite nail that hand. I mean, it looks a little weird. The left hand pushing out, thumb up, just about to run. Looks like Nagurski. Just always interesting. I just every once in a while, I get nostalgic and I go back and I look at these cards and I just study the detail.
Yep. And
The
again, it's classic 1930s style,
Yep.
which in a lot of cases younger collectors have no idea what it even means or what it
Yeah.
looks like. For
Yep.
a card almost 100 years old, it's
Yeah.
great as far as
Yeah.
I'm concerned.
Well, we were talking in our text group about some prices of Chickles that have been through the roof, like a PSA 3, just common card, or excuse me, a PSA 8 common card that was going for $3,000 or $4,000. I was like, boy, the price has skyrocketed. And I was like, well, my opinion is, a nearly 100-year-old card in PSA 8 of one of the most iconic sets, one of the first NFL sets in PSA 8 should be worth $3,000 or $4,000. So to me, if we're used to picking those up for $1,000. I mean, that's been cheap. 3,000 may be
Again,
the new norm.
I question how did these very high-end national chickens survive all these years? Because honestly, when I was looking in the several times I actually embarked on buying this, I saw the best was X at the most. I saw more GVG. I saw a handful of VGEX. I saw the one or two X condition. I never saw a near mint one raw. And I'm talking about the 80s and the 90s. Where did they all come from? They were miraculously hidden because some future vision person said, "Oh, let me put these away because I know back in 2010 I'll get $8,000 from them or whatever." Whatever.
Well, Al Crisafulli talked about that once, where he's like, I remember walking shows and all I saw were old beat up T206 baseball cards. Suddenly grading comes along and all these beautiful, pristine cards are suddenly out. He's like, I can, I could go years without seeing a perfectly cornered, tobacco card and suddenly grading and suddenly have all these perfect cards. I mean, is it naive to think, like these PSA 8s and PSA 9s haven't been touched by the card doctors in some way.
We've had this argument, not we've had this discussion for years now. And again, I just go back to what I saw. I lived the shows. I saw the shows. I was on both sides of the table in the shows in the 80s, in the 90s, in the 00s. I was there. I didn't have somebody running up to me and say, "Hey, Bob, I got a 35 National Chickle set near mint. You want to trade me some Pro Set boxes for it or whatever?" That stuff didn't happen. Okay. And again, if somebody offered me a national chickle, it was pretty beat up. And I understood it. I mean, I understood the history of that card. That card was not going to be a pristine card. Same thing you're talking about tobacco cards. I remember the Baltimore National, I'm pretty sure it was 2012. And a few dealers had a bunch of nice, what I thought were nice, raw tobacco cards, and they were $10 each. So I picked up probably 15 of them at that show, and I just liked the way they looked, and I figured I'd hold on to them down the road. I'll sell them, so on and so forth. And I'm pretty sure I sold them at the ridiculous price of like $25, $30 each because they were in relatively nice condition as the years went on. And I sold everything out. Okay, I'm at the National in 2025 in Chicago. I'm looking at basically two pieces of a card put together, which was considered to be a T206, actually broken in half, a common, $5. And I'm saying to myself, who in their right mind is going to spend $95 for a common that's broken in half? It defied logic to me. So, is what it is. I mean, there's a wild demand for those cards.
Who knows what the population, the actual population of these chickles are? I mean, 100, 200,
I really can't believe it's much more for the low series, more than probably 225, 250. For the high series, I really don't believe it's much, at the most, maybe 125, 150, at the most.
That is why my white whale continues to be a 35 chickel uncut sheep. So
I
I had a
believe it.
little bit of a like, oh my God, this euphoria. I forget what auction opened like 2 months ago, but they were selling sets off. But the photo that they had advertising it had all the cards butted up against each other. So they're
Oh
selling a
boy.
complete set minus Nagurski. And the photo had all the cards butted up against each other. And as you're swinging through looking at the little icons, I saw what looked to be an uncut sheet of chicle. It said like complete set 1935. And I'm like, what the hell? I mean, and I'm like, no, yes. And I click on it. I'm like, oh, USOBs, that's a complete set that you put up against each other. Oh, it was just funny. I just for a moment I was like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna have to start recycling some cans to get some money together for this thing.
Well, I still maintain you're going to be in the most illogical area in some part of the country. You're going to walk into some sort of antique shop, and there's going to be a bunch of pile of paper items, and there's probably going to be two or three cuts of the sheet there. And the person behind the counter says, "I don't know what they are. Give me $20 for everything." And
Yeah.
there's a whole
Well,
pile
the
of stuff there.
48 leaf uncut sheet I have here is two pieces.
Yeah.
And I know they're two separate sheets because there's like three cards that overlap. So when
Right.
I put that together, I just overlapped them and put it down. And I mean, some things it doesn't matter what the condition is. I have a 65 uncut sheet
Yeah, that's phenomenal.
that I bought from BST. And the Joe Namath, the Broadway Joe, is on the top row. He's
Yeah.
beating hell, but who cares? It's an
Yeah.
uncut sheet that has Joe Namath in it. It's pretty
Yeah.
cool.
Yeah. Your 48 leaf sheets there. I mean, how many are there in existence? I'm sure probably less than two or three, honestly.
I've only seen this one. I mean, I've seen little three card strip panels, but this is the only one I've ever seen. And I want to say it was like 18 years ago. Because it came up on eBay, and Dave Back called me. He's like, "You're not going to believe this, but an uncut sheet just came up, you know." And it's back in the auction days when you could reach out to the buyer. I'm like, "You know, I'll buy that from you know, if you take it offline." And he's like, "Sure." I mean, I think within an hour of Dave calling me, I'd negotiated an offline deal with the guy to take the
Yeah.
auction down. You know, what do you want for it? He's like, "I'm hoping for $3,000." I think was I'm like, "I'll take it." So I'm looking at like that. I haven't seen one since. That's a, you know, I was early to the hobby, you know, 18 years ago, but I haven't seen one since. So who
Right.
knows? Maybe they are.
I've never seen one. I've never seen literally any at any physical show I've been at. And I'll have to paraphrase that, not counting the Nationals. The most I ever saw were 1960 Fleer football strips, which
Yeah.
it's like six and eight card strips. And I,
Yeah.
the
They're
dealer
wild.
who had them there knew me, and he says, "You want them? I don't want to carry these around." And I said, "Yeah, I'll buy them from you." And I spent about 10 years selling those off,
Yeah.
and
I don't know why, but I've seen more 1960 Fleer with a row. So they're 10 card strips.
Right.
You know, just with an entire row, 10 or 11, I forget what the Fleer sheet is, but. And it's the whole sheet, but in strips. I've seen that like two or three times, and it's like, who's cutting these things up? Anyways, Golden has a really nice auction running right now, and I wanted to share one of the real highlights of that. Look at
Oh
this.
yeah. Yeah, I saw that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, did you? Are you the
No.
top bidder?
You know I'm not, so I'm not
Hey, you
gonna.
got to bid early, bid often, Cap. But look at that. That is a stunningly centered Jim Brown rookie card. Golden nabs some cards. Don't know. He's a used car salesman to me. He was just you know, pushing a video of him finding a PSA 1 Honus Wagner card that had been in a, you know, a grandfather's collectible book. Shows it in the book, and then here it is. And he's like, you know, look at this. So
Yeah.
he finds it, you know, he's like Al Rosen, Mr. You know, Mr.
Yeah.
Mr.
Yeah.
So, but what a
Nice
beautiful
card.
card. Not a lot of that, you know, that snow that appears usually, you know, on the card, beautifully centered, well deserving of the 8.5.
So correct me if I'm wrong. I thought it was several years ago, probably over 10 years ago, there were some 58 cello finds.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure whoever had them broke them and then pulled the best ones out of
Oh.
several of the cellos to get them graded and sold them off. So I'm wondering if that's a sale of a sale of a sale now down the road.
Well, you find 58 cellos you know that pop up, you know, and you'll find them, and what's funny is that 58 set, the card is either off center
Right.
and that cello will go for, you know, $2,000. Or centered, and it's $3,200, $3,400.
Right.
Throw a star in there. Like there's one that just sold, it had Leo Nomalelli, off centered, and it went for $2,800, $3,000. If that would have been centered, it, you know, add another 1,000 on it. So It's interesting. A 58 Cello is constantly $2,500, $2,800. That doesn't matter. No. Yeah.
And for whatever reason, enough of them have been found, so they're circulating the hobby again. So they're putting pretty much a leveling off of the pricing on it type of thing, as compared to when they were first found. They were red hot, obviously, because no one had seen them in such a long time, especially those unopened pack collectors.
Next up here, hang on. Next up is this card, one of your faves in the same golden auction.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful
Pretty
card.
good looking. I mean, a little skinny on the right. You never know, but an 8.5. I mean, this is an eight, is a $70,000 card. This 8.5 will probably be double that, $140,000, $150,000.
So again, I've had several people nudge me over the years and say, why don't you just get your Namath, get all your Namaths graded from 65, 66, 67, 68. And the thought has come to my mind on my 65 set to try to grade some of the stars out of it, because there is a lot of money there one way or the other. But I can't do it to the card and lock it in that plastic for the rest of its.
Card's got to breathe, Bob.
That's right. That's the way I feel about it. And
Well,
I don't
good.
know if I'll change my I'll change my philosophy down the road.
Who knows? But in that same Golden has two auctions running. One is this one that ends in 15 days, and the other one ends in 29. It has the Namath and the Jim Brown.
Okay.
I'd point out your two favorite cards, the 2000 playoff contender rookie ticket auto 144. It's obviously not the championship version.
Right.
That has the champion banner hanging that used to go for 2 million. This is just the common playoff contender rookie ticket. But here we are, PS or a SGC 10 there going for 22. But the kids, they love the BVG. So
Yeah.
this is the this one here is the preferred is the preferred. So good looking card. That autograph, is that Tom Brady or is that Michael J. Fox? Nobody.
And Fanatics has bought Beckett out, so they're basically. And I know we talked a little bit about this on VFC. I don't, I mean, okay, so we're eliminating all competition in grading. We're eliminating all competition as far as card production is concerned. So what are we truly trying to do here other than control the market? Which means one of two things. Either their experiment's going to end miserably for them as people turn away from collecting it, and B, does the vintage material now really make another major move, let's say from pre-war or 1888 up to 1988 type of situation? And I've been asked by a couple of people, can we really say the 100-year round of cards, 1888 to 1988, is going to be our new real vintage spectrum when we're looking at everything? And I said, very possible. It's very, very possible.
And I apologize, I get accidentally flashed a preview of my next topic. That's what I had for auctions. I just, you don't see a PSA 8.5 Jim Brown, PSA 8.5 Namath pop up very often.
They
Pretty impressive.
and the half grades have always interested me for the simple, okay, so how can you derive, you don't want to say it's an eight, nor do you want to say it's a nine. So you're saying it's an eight and a half. And that's why I really don't like half grades, because again, it's either going to be a strong eight or a strong nine. You're telling me with an 8.5, it has 50% eight and 50% nine. Okay. How do you come up with that?
Now that ship has sailed. I remember when half grades came out, the torches and pitchforks that went around, and the flurry of regrades that went in. I mean, yeah, it was all resubs and stuff like that. But we're talking before the show about the playoff picture. The four best teams have been decided this weekend, AFC Championship and the NFC Championship. The
That's right.
mighty Seattle Seahawks are playing in the NFC Championship. And really interesting stat, there's been one NFL team that has played in both the AFC and the NFC Championship, and it is the Seahawks. So I thought I would share. I've been a Seahawks fan my whole life. My parents had Seahawk tickets at the Kingdome when I grew up. I remember my first Seahawk game I went to. I was probably, so I used to watch them on TV. My birthday is in December, so I think I was around 11. My dad took me to my first Seahawk game for my birthday. And the game happened to be against the Raiders.
Wow.
And
Wow.
as I like to affectionately tell people, my two favorite teams in the NFL, Seattle Seahawks and whoever's playing the Raiders. Old AFC West rivalries never die. And to this
Right.
day, I still do not like the Raiders. Doesn't matter where they are, LA, Oakland, Vegas, my hatred chases them. And a lot of it boils down to this. The 1983-84 season AFC Championship. This was the deepest the Seahawks went into the playoffs for as long as I can remember. I mean, and I had, 3, 4 years of my mom screaming at the TV, catch that ball, tackle that guy, get him. So to make it this deep into playoffs was pretty amazing. So I looked it up. I just did a quick recap. And that 83-84 season was like this. Seattle Seahawks, we just drafted Kurt Warner. Nope, not the KURT Kurt, the CURT Kurt, the running back out of Penn State. We had the number three pick. We picked Kurt Warner. Amazing running back. His 84 tops card is one of my favorites, obviously outside of the 196 Steve Largent. But so along with Dave Craig, Dave Craig had replaced Jim Zorn at the time. Dave Craig, Steve Largent, and Kurt Warner went pretty deep into playoffs. The wild card round, Seattle was a wild card.
Right.
December 24th, 1983, Denver versus Seattle. This is the year before John Elway got drafted. So Steve DeBerg against Dave Craig. No, it would be Elway would be playing. Steve DeBerg played, and I guess I never looked up. I mean, I wonder if Elway was hurt because he was drafted the same year as Kurt Warner. Oh, anyways, I'll find out. Seattle at the Kingdome. That Seattle beats Denver at the Kingdome. Largent scored the first. He struck first. He scored the first touchdown. Dave Craig to Steve Largent. We move on to the divisional round. And it was these Cinderella story Seattle Seahawks. Let me stop sharing this real quick. And what I want to do is hang on, check this out.
So at that time, Seattle had only been in the league since 76.
76, yep.
Basically, it took a 7-year process
Not
for them to
bad.
reach where they were.
Not too bad. Well, here it was. I found this. So down on the bottom, Seattle at the Kingdome, beating Denver. We moved on to the divisional round, and you can see a young Seattle team went to the Orange Bowl and
Yep.
beat Dan Marino and the
And
Miami
Dolphins.
Dolphins. I can remember this game like it was yesterday. This was probably one of the most exciting games I'd watched because Miami was on fire. Dan Marino was setting records, and Seattle went into Miami and beat them. And I can, man, we watched it at my grandmother's house in Vancouver, Washington. I can remember this. I can remember the game. Just, yeah, just thought we were going to give it away. So I looked up a couple things, and it was like in the fourth quarter, see, Kurt Warner scored a 2-yard touchdown to take a 4-point lead. There was still lots of time left. And I remember a 4-point lead, but I mean, it was like two prize fighters exchanging blows because Miami struck first, seven. Seattle came back. Miami got a field goal. Seattle got a field. I mean, it was just exchanging points. So the first lead came with about 7 minutes left in the fourth quarter. Kurt Warner scores a 2-yard touchdown. I remember that one. Miami drove, ended up punting. Seattle had a long drive that took up a lot of time, and Norm Johnson kicked a 37-yard field goal with about a minute left to take a 7-point lead that lasted the rest of the game.
Wow.
Seattle beat Miami in the they were called the Cinderella Story Seahawks. The Cinderella Story.
And it's
Really?
interesting because the Raiders went all the way after that. After they
Yep.
beat Seattle in the
Yep.
AFC Championship game, they beat
Yep.
the Redskins at the time. But
And
the one
they
thing
rubbed the Redskins.
for
Marcus
our
Allen was the Super Bowl MVP. He was the NFL MVP. Yeah, there's another 1984 Topps card that shows Marcus Allen doing an end around and scoring like a 53-yard touchdown against the Hogs.
Wow. And the one thing I found interesting, and for our audience, if you look at the NFC
Picture.
divisional playoff, one of the last times Detroit ended up in the playoffs.
Oh, I didn't
So
even notice that.
they lost the squeaker to the 49ers, believe it or not, while Washington rolled over the Rams. And then they, again, San Francisco played hard in the championship game, lost to the Redskins, and then the Redskins had all sorts of problems in the Super Bowl. But it's interesting. It was one of the last times Detroit actually ended up in
And
the
that was
playoffs.
divisional. That means they won their division. Look at that, 51-7 over the Rams. I never noticed that. That was a thrubbing.
That was the Rams defeated the Cowboys. And then they went into the next to the divisional playoff, and then they got slumped by the Redskins. The Redskins
Yeah.
were powerful, and that's why everybody was saying right after that playoff game, well, nobody's going to stop the Redskins now.
Yeah.
And sure enough, they had a tough time with the 49ers in the championship game, and then they couldn't handle the Raiders and ended up losing.
This Seahawks game, 30-14, seems close. It wasn't. LA jumped out to a 27-0 lead. They were ahead 20-0 at halftime. Third quarter, they jumped out to a 27-0 lead before at the end of the third quarter, the Seahawks scored a touchdown to make it 37-7 or 27-7. Raiders got a field goal to make it 30-7, and then the Seahawks with 2 minutes left scored another touchdown, 30-14. So that was a take, yeah, it looks close. It was not.
Wasn't close. Yeah.
Yeah, sadly. A friend of mine was asking, because I have several friends who are going to the, going to the NFC Championship in Seattle this year, this Sunday. And they're like, well, gosh, how many NFC championships, how many times can you go to an NFC championship? And I was
Yeah.
like, I don't know. That's a good question. So I looked it up. How many NFC championships have been in Seattle? And the answer is three. The 3 times that we've been to the Super Bowl, 2005, six, where we lost to the Steelers here. C, Seattle lost to or B, Carolina at Quest Field. That was an NFC championship. And then the 13 and 14 season, both championships were here. So here's where this is why I spell Steeler, Steeler, because they stole that Super Bowl from us along with the referees. I still blame the referees for that one. An offensive pass interference in the end zone to take that one. So here's an NFC championship at Quest Field. Seahawks were that was Sean Alexander, Matt Hasselbeck. It was a good team. Last time a running back. Or I think that was one of the first times a running back was the league MVP with Sean Alexander.
Right.
That one, Hang on, I have to lock and load some of these.
It's still to me very impressive for Seattle to have been involved in that many championship games and actually have their one Super Bowl ring at the same time. You know what I mean?
Yep. Here's the 2013, 2014 championship. And you can see this is Seattle going on to the first one. This is what the game against San Francisco at CenturyLink now. And that's the game we refer to as just the tip, because Richard Sherman in the back of the end zone against Michael Crabtree. Colin Kaepernick throws a fade. Sherman lays himself out, catches the tip of the ball, and bounces it back to Mack Smith, linebacker, for an interception in the end zone with about a minute left. Seahawks came out and basically took a knee, and and the new rivalry was born against the 49ers. So another, and then we went on to have one of the greatest Super Bowls in NFL history against the Peyton Manning and the with his new team, the Denver Broncos. And then lastly was, hang on, I have to do this
And
one.
everybody really thought Denver was going to win that game, and they were, in my opinion, not prepared whatsoever for that game.
Not me, Bob. I knew the Seahawks were going to win that game against Denver. And here's one that might still sting a little bit. If you look down at that NFC Championship, back-to-back NFC Championships at CenturyLink. And that one was against the Green Bay Packers. The debacle. I'm sure you guys call it the debacle in Seattle.
There was.
That was, I looked that up. I remember I was traveling that day, and I left San Francisco, where I was down there on a business trip, and Seattle was down 19-7. They were down, and I remember I'm like, oh boy, this looks good. This looks bad. An hour and a half later, whatever, I landed in Portland, and it was 19-7 with 10 minutes and 53 seconds left in the fourth. Seattle scored a touchdown with 1:25 to go. And a 2-point conversion to take the lead, or excuse me, they scored a touchdown, 14, and then Seattle scored a touchdown with a 2-point conversion. Green Bay to take a 22-19 lead. Green Bay tied with a field goal to make it 22 all, going into overtime in the NFC Championship. And Russell Wilson from 45 yards out hit Javon Kearse in the end zone for a touchdown. No extra point needed.
Unbelievable.
Yep.
I can still see that in my head.
Yep. There was a bobbled onside kick there to get that touchdown with 1:25 to go and a 2-point conversion to tie it up. But yeah, and that. There's the lesson, the onside kick. When your hands crew is in to get an onside kick that is needed, and the stakes are a ticket to the Super Bowl,
Right.
you make sure a second string tight end isn't one of the people in there, I guess. So, and this obviously went on to be the Super Bowl where, yeah, why not hand it off to beast mode when there's a minute left and it's first and goal on the 2-yard line with the Super Bowl on the line? But instead, inside slant, interception by Butler, game over.
Unbelievable.
That is it.
Well, on my end, and we're getting close to the witching hour here, my limited amount of Seattle Seahawk memorabilia includes these Earl Wheaton
Euro wheat.
1990
Eugene
cards,
Robinson. Yeah.
a handful of them. And I was trying to think back where I got them. I remember at that time in the early 90s, I was trading with a lot of people. And I have a feeling I had some regional issue from the tri-state area or Patriots issue, and the person I traded with sent me those cards. And as I was telling you before the show, in one of the classes I taught years later in the 90s, I had Eugene Robinson's first cousin as one of my students. And she said to me, "Let me see if I could get you an autograph." And I said, "Oh, that'd be cool." But she wasn't able to pull it off. But these were nice cards. I like them. I mean,
I like them. You know what's funny?
sent
I can
well.
smell those through the screen.
And they have a nice red, white, and
Yep.
blue background.
Good looking set. I can
And
literally smell those. The beautiful smell of bread.
yeah.
I
Now,
mean,
correct me if I'm wrong, from the little research I was able to find on them, they were inserted into an actual a loaf bread package. Were they cellophane wrapped, or they were okay? All right.
cellophane, yeah. A little cellophane wrapper stuffed into the bread. I can remember opening
Okay.
it. I can remember getting the Oro wheat bread, taking the entire loaf out, grabbing the card, and then trying to stuff the loaf back in. It never went good.
Yeah.
Kind of like when you had the toys and cereal,
Yeah. Yep.
and you just dig through or
Yeah.
dump the whole thing into a bowl and then put it back. And I mean, I don't know about you, but we ended up having to have rules about, what you could do to recover the, toy out of the cereal box. But
Yeah.
yeah,
And
no.
it was interesting in I'm pretty sure it was 88 and 89, Wholesome Breads of New England had a Patriots set in the bread. And I vaguely remember buying a few packs of the bread to try to get the cards out. I did get a couple of cards, and then I they became prevalent on the marketplace as people got them for whatever reason. There was a lot of warehouse finds of those as the years went on. But that's a cool regional
It
Seahawks set.
is.
Now, do you have any of the Nally's ship?
I was just gonna say,
You
hang
have
on, I'm looking.
one,
I
right?
don't have a picture of it, but yes, I do have Nally's. And again, I can smell that box. I'm looking, I do not. I can smell that box. And it's funny because Nally's started in like 78, 70,
Yeah.
I think it went through 84.
Yeah.
They all changed. And you would buy the box of Nally's chips, which is just a big salty, thing. And I'd cut them out, I'd thumbtack them to my wall. And then the next year they'd come out and you don't really think about it. And you know how much of this hobby, one of the things I love about this hobby is you'll just see something and you'll be like, oh my gosh, I forgot about that. I love it. I have to have that. I mean, I don't know if you can see it, but this poster right here. There you go.
Oh yeah, okay. Yep.
Like a year ago, somebody on our VFC showed a picture of the Eagles one, I believe.
Right.
I was like, I remember those. And I went out and found the Seahawk one, and I sat and stared at it for so long. I'm like, man, I remember the detail of that. I
Yeah,
don't
yeah.
remember what year it is, but I remember the detail. I bought one for, $20 on eBay. It cost me
Yeah.
$50 to frame it. And it hangs there because
That
it's.
presents so nicely though. That's a perfect type of piece you want to hang on your wall. Because you
Yeah.
got memory of it, it's well made, it was well produced, you have the
Yeah.
memory of it at the same time. You can't go wrong with something like that, no matter how much it
Yeah.
costs to frame or whatever.
Yeah. Who cares? I mean, I didn't go, well, I don't need UV frame or UV glass or anything like that, but it was cool. I mean, and there's so many of those things where you see it and you're like, gosh, I just remember that. I totally forgot about it. I
Yeah.
know Nally's were the same way. I remember seeing one like 15 years ago and just going, oh my gosh, I remember having those thumbtacked to my bedroom wall. What the hell? So I just started collecting the larger ones. They're pretty fun.
I remember the Nally's a few times at the National. I saw a couple of dealers had a few odd ones, and I never purchased one just to have a type one. Over the years, at one time I had a lot of oddball football sets, including a lot of police sets, safety sets, You know pretty much my collection. So I really had I had well over 150 police sets, so forth. And I just there was just something to me about the oddball set that I loved, or the insert set that I loved more than the regular base set. And to this day, I just have such an appreciation for oddball football cards, insert football cards, regional football cards, all that kind of stuff. I
What are the
just
Packer regional sets? Because, like, I did a Gridiron article on the 76 Fred Meyer, which is a grocery store here locally, 76 Fred Meyer Seahawks set.
The
And
Packers,
then,
you got the Lake to Lake Packers of
like, the
60.
lake, but that was 61. I mean,
Yeah. Yeah,
what, I mean, there, I mean, I think about how many regional sets there are for Seattle. I mean, we
yeah.
just talked about two or three, and I mean, what, I mean, the police set. I didn't realize the police set was nationwide. I mean, so I was really surprised. I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. I mean, I mean,
I think the marketing of regional sets was popular up until the end of the 90s.
yeah.
For example, the Packers police set run started in 1983, and I believe it ended right at 2019, and then they just stopped it. And that's sad because they were the longest established police set issuing team in the country and in the league. A lot of teams issued them late 70s, early 80s, and then once the 90s hit, they pretty much faded them out. And for whatever reason, a lot of collectors just didn't like them for the simple reason they're, above a standard
Got it.
card size. You probably got to get a six pocket sheet to put them if you want to display them. But I just thought they were just a real nice collectible overall. There are a lot of really rare police sets out there. I mean, safety sets, police sets, team issued sets.
Police set, the McDonald's set,
Yeah.
the scratch offs. I mean, it's funny as a kid, like 86 McDonald's, I thought those were, just Seattle. And it's just when I started getting back and collect, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Those are all over the place.
Yeah.
But I mean, like I said, I mean, were you not privy to like Green Bay Packer local sets? I mean,
Well, I discovered them in the 80s. I knew they had some of them. I knew about the Lake to Lake back in the 70s. I never owned one. So in the 80s, when a lot of stuff started coming out, I started collecting them. And I never saw it before, so I wanted to collect it. And I used one example. It had to have been probably in 83 or 84. I was set up at a card show, and a guy came over with this like square box of stuff, and it was cards, all football. He just wanted to get rid of them, but I noticed there were a bunch of police cards in them, police set cards in them. They weren't complete sets or anything. They were just like singleton cards everywhere, and it was very popular at that time. The police departments worked out with the schools that the kids would get one card a week from the team, with the police, printing on the back of it, or PAL or whatever it was that they were issuing. So a lot of kids, would have three or four cards. They wouldn't have the set. They would give up on it or whatever, and they would throw it. So this guy had, I mean, I couldn't believe what he had. So I started sorting a lot of stuff out. I did make up a handful of police sets out of it, but I just became more and more fascinated about them. And then I started slowly buying them. And again, that time they were relatively inexpensive. They were like $1 and $2 a set. And then they reached and went up in price again, and they were $5, $6, $10, depending on rarity. So they were starting to pick up a little steam. And then lately, over the past 10 years, I was at the National this past year. Something I noticed too: a guy had a bunch of baseball police sets. They were $1 a set. And I'm saying it's really sad to see that, because you do have some stars in some of these sets, and you can't even get more than $1 for them. It's amazing. And football police sets, really, unless they're real early first year type, or they have a really superstar in them, they just don't have a lot of value.
I don't remember when the first police Seahawks set is. I want to say 81 or 82. No, 70,
I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was,
79.
yeah, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was 79. And you had a pretty good run up to, I want to say, 93 or 94. I'll have to double check on that.
Yeah, obviously I stopped collecting them in 89.
Yeah, because of the more large. And I remember at one time I did have a pretty good collection of all the different teams that issued them. I didn't have a master set by any way, shape, or form, because that was going to be a lot of sets and a lot of different backs from the differing issuing agency that
Yeah. Oh,
and I
didn't
wasn't
know.
aware of those.
Well, it's like the McDonald's set. There were four basic colors. It was like black, orange, green, and
The red.
red. Oh, yeah, red. And then they
Black,
started coming out with, okay,
orange, and one.
this isn't orange. This is like a tangerine. I'm like,
Yeah.
no, they issued them in four colors. All you have to do is go to their website. You can see McDonald's issued them four colors.
Yeah.
They don't. And it's these master set collectors who are like, this isn't orange. This is a misprint. I don't know. It's
Right. And
you.
again, it was a challenge back in 86 and 1986 to try to collect all four colors of a team
Yeah.
and together a master set. I tried doing that for a while, but I gave up on it, and then I decided I just wanted one team each, which is what I ended up having. And then I sold that off. I did keep my Packer McDonald's sets that I have. And 1993 was the same deal. The Game Day issued McDonald's Game Day team sheets for the different teams, and then they had an all-star set of three sheets that were given to locations that didn't have a local team.
Game day team sheets? What's that?
They were issued from McDonald's, and they were
Oh, gotcha.
game sets from the
Gotcha.
93, 92 and 93 Game Day football cards, which were the 1965 Tall Boys. So anyways, that was an exciting promotion, and a lot of people got into it. But again, shortly, a year or two after, all of a sudden, these unopened boxes of thousands of Game Day McDonald's cards come to the market, and there goes the price of them. And
It is kind of funny, isn't it? Yeah.
anyways, what a great trip down memory lane. And we're almost out of time. Joe, I wish you luck on Sunday. I'll be thinking of you. And I will be secretly rooting for you so you can get back into the Super Bowl, because I know you'll be comping some Super Bowl tickets here, wherever the game is. I don't even know where the game's being played this year. And
It's in Santa Clara. It's in San Francisco.
so you got an easy ride down to pick up your tickets.
Ah, man, I don't know. There's been a lot of talk about like, would you go? I really need to, but I'm also very lazy lately.
It doesn't excite me if I got to spend $25,000
I
for a ticket
know.
for some ridiculous.
And if I were to do it, I would probably, when we went to the Oregon Auburn BCS championship, Stacy was the on the endowment for the University of Oregon. So we got tickets at face value. So $200 each. So we went with her sister. We're in the parking lot walking up to the game and somebody comes up and is like, I'll give you 2,000 a ticket. And I'm like, yeah. Stacy's like, no, we came all this way. We flew to Phoenix. We're going to go see the game. We go in, Oregon loses. And I'm like, man, I think there was a better view at the bar,
Well, it was the same thing with that Army Navy ticket. When we were leaving the Army Navy game, and we had split up because I had to go get a ride to get back to the hotel. I had a guy come up to me and says, "I'll give you 300 cash for the ticket." And I said, "No." And the next day, literally that night, they were on eBay, and they were pumping them for $400, $500, $600 each.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I'm saying to myself, no, I'm not going to sell that. That is
That's your ticket.
fundamental of my game. I have a game program, and I actually have one of the few tickets that were issued for that game.
Yeah.
So I'm
Oh,
not
yeah.
going to.
I love it.
And you did the right thing not selling it either. It's not the 4,000 is immaterial to this.
Yeah. But if I were to go to a Super Bowl, I would go and I would do all the festivities, all the activities outside the Super Bowl.
Right,
And
right.
then when you walk into the game, I would take a right and go to some Irish pub and
Yeah, I
watch
get it.
the
I get it. I get it. Hey, we're out of time. That's it. We'll be back in 2 weeks. I'm not going to be around next week, and we will have another show. Thanks for watching. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting
What are
for?
you waiting for?
GridironGreatsMagazine.com. Thanks, and we'll be in. Seeing you soon. Take care.
Hi everyone, there's a new podcast in town, Statman and Robin. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history.
We have lots of stories to tell about the great and not so great teams and players in Baltimore's rich sports history, and some of the more obscure ones too.
We grew up together with these teams and players, and we'll add our experiences to these great stories.
Yep, we were there for a lot of them. Join us here on the Sports History Network.